Hi everyone, Jenny here. Welcome to a galaxy not so far away. For the next couple of episodes, we will be covering issues having to do with mental health. Our booksellers will be sharing their personal experiences while also discussing myriad topics having to do with mental health and disability, including depression, trauma, neurodiversity, and others. We hope you feel welcome as a part of this discussion. However, if you find these topics potentially triggering, we recommend you proceed with caution, and please take time to check in with yourself along the way.
And welcome to A Galaxy Not So Far Away, a Mysterious Galaxy podcast. I'm your host, Becca.
And I'm Gary.
And today we have with us Victoria.
Hello.
And Jenny.
Hi.
And this is going to be the first in two parts?
Probably two parts. I think we're going to try and do Kellyanne and Nick next time.
All right, cool. Of our mental health discussion. Gary, do you happen to remember who suggested this episode?
Oh my goodness. It was a customer. Someone who had posted on, I think, a comment on Instagram.
Let me go to my wholesome customers.
It's
Halloween Pumpkin Queen.
Pumpkin Queen. Yeah.
So thank you, Halloween Pumpkin Queen, for suggesting this episode. Obviously, it is a topic that a lot of us deal with in fan spaces in general, but also definitely in the book world, which is a topic we will jump into later in this, but Jenny has done a wonderful thing for us and made a really nice, clear sort of outline of where we're going to go with what, so things can stay, you know, emotional and honest, but not, like, descend into chaos with me probably crying. I am the crybaby of the group. I know who I am.
That's fair. That's allowed. Where do we want to start? You know what? I just have this thing that Jenny sent us. You have an outline.
I was going to say, well, Gary.
So something that,
yeah.
Something that I think would be really great to discuss because I actually, weirdly enough, have not experienced this, you know, topic. Jenny, can you talk a little bit about person first versus identity first language?
I can. Okay, so...
Because I've never heard this before, and I'm, like, so excited to learn.
You've probably heard it, but haven't heard it termed as such. And I'm just going to say this now. Gary, I apologize for you having to edit around my silences. I'm having
a lot of kind totally of
cognitive
it's totally fine.
Failures that are going to make some silence.
I have just a template that's set up that just cuts out any silence that's more than a second long.
Okay.
On its own. So I don't even have to worry about
that's
it.
That's amazing.
It's really great. It's fantastic.
For,
I love it.
For Jenny and I.
Yeah. Okay. So person first, first identity, first language. This is kind of a debate that's been going on for a long time about what is the kind of correct or preferred terminology when used to describe disabled communities. The kind of more traditional language is what we call person first, which would be where you phrase person who has a disability or person who is autistic, where the kind of the name or the kind of the idea of the person is the first thing that's prioritized. This is really common and kind of grew out of what are sometimes referred to as caring professions or from the medical industry. And the intention behind it is to prioritize the individual and sort of make the disability secondary in that phraseology. Now,
okay, that makes a lot of sense. So it's I've heard this discussion a lot around the use of certain physical like assistance pieces, like you know, walkers and wheelchairs and the like.
Yes, so that...
I hear a lot of the conversation around that and how not to, you know, word it, because I think that it's really important, like, once you realize how the language affects the person.
Yeah, so things like person who uses a wheelchair is very common across the board. And this, and again, like, this is I should have said this at the beginning, but the default, like when you are talking about this, if you have the opportunity to ask the person who you are referring to what they prefer, that should always be the default, because it is not universal. However, in recent-ish years, we'll say in the last decade or so, there's been more of a push for what is called identity first language that has come from the disabled community. And this is sort of the rhetorical opposite in that it would be disabled person as opposed to person with a disability. And the reason for this is very particular and it's very intentional. And it is to highlight the fact that one, that disability is a part of someone's identity. It's a cultural identity and it is part of who they are. And so the move to distance the disability from the individual, while it may be well-intentioned, can further kind of marginalize the disability and continue to keep disabilities marginal and seen as lesser.
I mean, absolutely. That makes sense because like every time it just feels, I guess, a bit infantilizing.
Yes.
It feels like it very much fits the narrative of like, you're more than your disability or you're more than
exactly
this disease that you have. And it's like, well yes, but also like it will, that's something I've been like dealing with a lot lately, which is understanding like it will always be there.
Yeah.
Like the chronic means forever.
Exactly. And it also like, so, I mean, what you're saying, Becca, too, hits on like a huge conversation about especially disabled children, essentially, and the idea of calling them differently abled or special with all of the kind of implications of special in the special education sense, which is not terminology that you would use to describe an adult. And so trying to kind of embrace and kind of understand disability as part of the human spectrum is important. The other kind of last part, I guess, for identity first language, that there's an activist, former activist called Stella Young. She passed away a few years ago, but she has a TED talk that I highly recommend everybody watch. It's called I'm Not Your Inspiration. Thank you very much. It is wonderful. It is funny. And just one of my favorite things to kind of share with people. But the way she phrases it too, when she talks about talking about herself as a disabled person, is to highlight the fact that she is disabled by society and sort of societal standards and normative expectations of her ability. She uses a wheelchair. If there are stairs and no ramp, she is being disabled by that situation. It's an active understanding of the adjective, essentially. It's turning it into that sort of active motion. If there is a ramp, she is not disabled in that situation, but to kind of highlight the active role our environment plays in disabling particular individuals. And this connects then to what are called the social and medical model of disability, which I don't think we necessarily need to get into here, but in short, the medical model locates the disability or the problem within the individual and talks about it as something that needs to be cured. Whereas a social model locates the barriers within society and sort of normative expectations of behavior and ability that will always automatically disable certain groups of people.
Mm. I do want to say too here, just like it's really important to me as someone with many family members who have been on the Down syndrome and autism spectrums, I think that there's a lot of issues too with a lot of the organizations attached to disabilities. And so like, I think that like so much of that also like is positive reinforcement to these terrible stereotypes. Like, gosh, I cannot autism remember speaks. For the like,
yep.
Is that the puzzle one?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. My nephew is, very high functioning and like, they like completely infantilized him the one time that there was any contact there.
Yeah. And so
yeah, never again.
Autistic communities are one of the communities that is really, really kind of fight for that identity identity first language. It is kind of, even amongst disabled communities, it is more common in certain ones than others. Deaf communities, autistic communities, and I believe blind communities in particular are kind of very strongly as pushing for that sort of identity first language. Another really great resource that I have, especially with regards to autism and what you're talking about, Becca, if your cousin's family is interested in it as a resource, is a friend of mine who, not a close friend necessarily, I know her through academia and through doing conferences with her over COVID. She got really into TikTok and she started a TikTok account called Auteach, A-U-T-E-A-C-H.
Oh my gosh, I think I follow her.
Yes. And so it's a really, really great resource that's geared towards parents of autistic children. She is autistic, her daughter is autistic. And so a lot of it kind of comes from her experience navigating a lot of the educational structures, the access structures, the care structures, from that position, and really trying to help other families navigate those systems as well, because there's a lot of, in the same way, a lot of the kind of organizations like Autism Speaks have a lot of problems. Those kinds of problems infect in a lot of different areas. And I mean, this is where, like, I can really go on a tangent about ABA and,
well, I can step in if you want. Something I really love about TikTok is, it's a double-edged sword here. I'll just say that, but a lot of the adult mental health community there is very precious to me. I specifically want to, shout out, not a professional, but just like someone that lives with the, you know, with ADHD and, you know, discusses it and sort of like shares, you know, what she has learned through her experience getting treatment. Katie Osoris, honestly, probably one of the best resources that I have found in all of my years of having ADHD. Including like recently being like reaffirmed in my diagnoses and not being told that ADD is an outdated term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I had no idea that like, because I kept finding ADHD material that I related to, and I got really concerned that I was misdiagnosed. And then I had to find out from the internet that literally it's the same thing. And honestly, if I had a dime for every time that I found out that a symptom I was experiencing was related to something I was diagnosed with via someone else on the internet discussing their symptoms, like, I wouldn't have very much money, but I would have more than necessary.
It's complicated.
We had a recent event with Kristen O'Neill, who wrote Lycanthropy and Other Chronic Illnesses, which is about disability. It's not particularly about mental disability, although it does deal with kind of the connection between physical and mental. One of the things we talked about, because it's represented in her book really, I think, well, is kind of the importance of online spaces for disabled communities, and sort of how that way of finding information and learning has been so valuable in so many ways for a lot of people, and kind of the way you're talking about, Becca, and like finding answers through non-medical channels, we'll say.
I think it's really great that you brought up like the correlation between mental and physical health, because also something I learned within the past, you know, during quarantine, was that a lot of my chronic pain can be related back to the physical stress of like things I'm diagnosed with. And you know, as someone that has been very open about having been in recovery for a pretty severe eating disorder, I've always just sort of looked at my chronic pain as a weird, like, cosmic punishment for hurting my body. And it's taken until, like, now in adulthood to understand that, like, these things are part of a disabling, you know, symptom of my disorder. And it's something that I'm still not, as you can hear, not 100% comfortable, like, you know, outlining, but it is something that I think not enough people, like, acknowledge how much mental health can strain your body and hurt mm-hmm. it and, like, make it harder for you to physically exist.
Well, and, like, doing that introspection and, like, doing that work of going and finding resources to kind of better understand the things that you're going through is admirable. And, like, it's a hard thing to do. Like, I know for me personally, especially when I was in, like, high school and, like, fresh out of high school and college, and I was really dealing with a lot of, like, anxiety and depression. Like, it's so much easier sometimes to just, like, bury yourself in work or projects or something else rather than, like, focusing on the thing that's causing you distress. I think that someone in the notes doc mentioned, like, the difference between doing something that's good for your mental health and then using it as an escape.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the biggest issue that we face in the fandom space across all types of fiction is a lot of us latch onto it young mm-hmm. and it becomes literally about escapism from, like, bad parts of life, which isn't, like, anyone's fault. It's very much just, like, as we're growing up with technology advancing as we age, it's just a natural part of life.
Yeah.
But I'm sitting here, like, while I find myself now at 26 a lot more balanced in understanding who I am and what I like, I'm still surrounded by, like, cartoon girl figures and, like, Garfield stuff and, like, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But I also acknowledge that a lot of my fandom interests are, you know, related to escapism and, like, my hyper focus issues.
Yeah.
And I do wish that, and it's not something that my parents were even aware was a problem, because, you know, I am of that weird gap generation between Gen Z and Millennial where, like, I did grow up sitting on the couch watching TV, and then I did, you know, slowly advance with, like, you know, phones and tech and whatever. Yeah. So, like, my parents were, like, the first parents to have to deal with, like, how do I regulate technology? And for them, they were so busy that it just, you know, fell to the wayside because I seemed like I was doing all right. And I do now think about that all the time about, like, you know, potentially raising kids as I'm getting older. And I'm like, man, I see why parents freak out sometimes and are like, no phone, no going outside.
Yeah.
Like, I'm so, as someone that was, you know, used, abused, and groomed by adults on the internet in the early 2000s, I am so fiercely protective of children on the internet, and it freaks me out. Like, I wish that someone had been there to be like, hey, maybe you should, like, look at what's going on around you instead of just, like, watching Inuyasha and reading Inuyasha.
Yeah, I you know, both with, I don't know, all sorts of things. I think I still kind of do this. I have a tendency when I was a kid, especially in high school, middle school, high school, was, like, carrying books around with me. I was, like, moving a lot and having a hard time making friends. And it was sort of a retreat of, like, oh, I can just, like, sit in the back of this classroom with this book, or, like, I can go home and, like, binge this television series or whatever. And there's, like, a reclusiveness that, I think I'm still, like, struggling with. It's easy to, like, go home and play that new video game for a few hours before bed and going back to work the next day rather than, like, going out and doing stuff with people or, like, working on other projects that I'm interested in. It's tough sometimes.
Victoria, do you have any thoughts on this? I want to hear from you. You know, you're my favorite.
I think a lot of it is almost like a comfort blanket, like a security blanket.
Yeah.
So when you start to feel, like, super stressed or depressed or any of that, you latch on to those things and you want them because they bring you back to when you felt secure. I mean, it's the reason I can't go anywhere without, like, 5 books on me. And I'm horrible. I take them everywhere. I've taken them to weddings. I mean, also then, like, it becomes more of a, you would rather be with your books than real people, which, by all means, I want that quite a bit. But then it also, it's just, you have to understand why you turn to those things and mm-hmm. what it is that you're truly trying to avoid. Like, if you're trying to force yourself to be an extrovert, but then you take books everywhere so you can, like, hide in them, maybe you should stop forcing yourself to go to those, like, parties and situations, because that's just doing mm-hmm. stress to your brain, and that's not good.
Yeah.
And also, like, if you're looking to those things for comfort and to try to, like, bring your emotional and, like, physical state up, and so you don't feel so sad, it's... Some people are able to, like, self-medicate that way, but you shouldn't always rely on that. Because it can yeah. it can cause bigger problems down the line.
I also think, too, that, like, it can lead to a lot of unrealistic expectations mm-hmm. of interaction.
Yes.
Like, that is definitely something that I struggled with a lot in, like, you know, elementary and middle school, being so heavily, like, part of online fandom spaces and sort of like I stayed up late every night to watch new episodes of stuff on Adult Swim because like that was the only way to do it then mm-hmm. and like I was so far attached like detached from how everyone else my age was except for like a couple like people that I just couldn't understand why I was so different from everyone. Like I was like, what's wrong with them? I'm so ahead. I was not.
Yeah, I very much just, like, I had the books that I liked, and I just reread them, and just mm-hmm. spent all of my free time, like, in these fictional spaces. I don't know. It's harder to, it's, you've got to learn to, like, balance that, I think, with.
Yeah, I think it's good, because they can help you, and when you find those things that can help you, you should definitely, like, use them. You just can't let yourself fall down the rabbit hole.
Yeah. Jenny, I feel like you were about to say something.
I'm trying to figure out how, like, I want to say this, because I do think that there are ways to travel with books, we'll mm-hmm. say, but not have them be focused on escapism mm-hmm. in a disconnecting
yeah.
way. Yeah, totally.
Personally, like, one of the things that I have to do for my mental health is read every day, because that is something mm-hmm. that I have found, for me at least, strongly affects my mood. If I stop reading, then I, like, within 3 days, my mood is noticeably lower. It is not good for my depression at all, even if I'm just reading, like, for 5 minutes at night. So the idea of having books and reading a lot and reading, I'm someone though who has like really built my life around what books can do for people and in forms of connection. So I do think it has to do with the way you position the books in relation or the media or whatever it is. In as a way of connection. And of course, though, like, as when Becca was kind of getting at with, like, it gives false impressions of kind of connection, there's a lot of really, really terrible things that have been shown and repeated through literature and through film and media over the years that have created a lot of, like, the problems that people have or the assumptions people make about mentally disabled communities, about mentally disabled women in particular, that come from literature. So I don't know, I guess I'm trying to figure out what the line is then between, like,
I mean, I think it's about representation versus, like, exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, a lot, like, when you look at, I have to say this, even though I'm very sensitive to the fact that she's not this way anymore and is also one of my favorite characters to ever exist, but very much when Harley Quinn was first introduced, like, I think that it was an exploitation of, like, I don't know how mental health in women can look, because, like, mm-hmm. she was literally, like, modern day hysteria, like, went from being, like, a completely, like, intelligent psychiatrist working at, like, one of the most, like, important places in the entire city, mm-hmm. and then just, like, threw her entire life away. And I'm not saying it's not plausible, like, it is, but, like, I think that a lot of stuff is very exploitative in that it's made using the, what am I trying to say? It's made through the lens of, what is the word? Bias. It's through the lens of bias of whoever's making it. And then a lot of their opinions come out for better or for worse. And, you know, depending on the age you are, like, especially with, like, Harley Quinn, I think the first time I saw her, I was, like, 4? Mm. Like, it's very formative to your brain and, like, what then you think is, like, a healthy response, I guess. Because, like, for me, very much, I was like, wow, she would do anything for the person she loves. I should do that, too.
Yikes.
And, you know, when you're, like, a little kid, that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's totally a viable impression. And then you see, like, you know, the obvious, like, play of abuse. And it's just, like, I think, I don't know. I got a lot of feelings about it.
I'm gonna step in on this one. Because, Becca, I think what you hit on the head, though, like, Harley Quinn and her relationship to the Joker is very, like, a gendered relationship with madness that is founded in a long history of literature and a long history of, like, mm-hmm. historical figures. Like, the easiest example is Hamlet, where Hamlet spends the entire play people telling him that he's gone mad, that he's losing, like, they talk about him constantly saying that he is mad. And then Ophelia comes in and sings her song, and it doesn't make sense to anyone, because I could go into this for a long time. And all of a sudden now she becomes a document in madness because she is the woman. And male madness is seen as being able to be channeled into ingenious mm-hmm. villainy for the Joker's case, but in a lot of historical cases into the genius male artist.
Right. I feel like the modern equivalent is, like, you either get, like, someone like the Joker, or you get someone who looks at women in, like, the manic pixie dream girl lens.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Of, like, so it's either they're like, I'm mentally ill and therefore genius, or I'm mentally ill and therefore need to abuse women to make myself feel better.
So this sort of, like, gendered happening was a huge part of my dissertation. My favorite quote about this actually is from Carl Jung, and he was talking about James Joyce, who wrote Ulysses and Phineas mm-hmm. Wake and Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man, and his daughter. His daughter was diagnosed with several things throughout her life. Schizophrenia is the most lasting diagnosis. And one of the things Carl Jung described their relationship as is, you are both like two people falling into water. One is diving, the other drowning. So it's essentially figuring James Joyce as the person who can control his descent and dive and not drown, while the female, who is this, like, the other side of the same coin, because they shared a lot of their characteristics, she was institutionalized repeatedly. She was abused in several ways. Joyce, her father, was one of the only people who stayed by her through her entire life, and worked really hard to support her. But this kind of gendered understanding of male geniuses, male madness is genius, female madness is disorderly and disruptive and destructive, and sort of this sort of, it makes me really mad, obviously.
Fair.
But, like, it then goes into, right, like, in Jane Eyre and the Mad Woman in the Attic, which then that became a theoretical text that was huge in feminist theory for a long time. But then what started happening is female experiences of disability started being read as metaphoric reactions to patriarchal imposing structures.
Yeah.
So
like the yellow wallpaper?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She did not want to be a feminist icon at all.
Yes. So, like, female illustrations of mental disability. And this is something that's common with disability overall, just in general. It often, in literature, is read metaphorically. It becomes a stand-in for something else. And for women and mental disability, that stand-in or that something else is usually the patriarchy or like the woman not being able to handle the world sort of thing. And I forgot where I was going with this. I promise I had a direction at one point. Virginia Woolf writes a lot about this. I really like how she talks about it. As someone who had a very modern understanding of gender and a very sort of reflective position on her mental health and her mental disability, thinks a lot about this kind of gendered relationship as well. I just feel like I took us on a huge tangent because I was gonna rant about something.
No. Honestly, like, I think it's totally, it all connects mm-hmm. because, like, now I'm just thinking about, like, how so much of, like, my youth was me looking to characters that I thought, you know, represented certain, like, characteristics that I needed to reflect. But then in the reality, I was also emulating, like, every hyper-masculine character I could find. Like, I literally, like, I've dressed up as the Joker several times in several iterations over my life because I was that cringy kid. And, like, I was just always, like, much more drawn to that than I was, like, the actual reality of what I thought femininity was. And as I've gotten older and, you know, came out as non-binary, I've come to understand that it's very much about who is creating the fiction that we're consuming. Because, like, this is something we discussed on the last episode when we were talking about magical girl manga. And what you see is this distinct change in that genre when companies realized they could make a lot of money off of adult men who were very obsessed with these teenage girl characters. And then they started hiring men to write the manga and the anime. And what we got was hyper-violence on a level that, like, otherwise should have never really been part of this genre. Like, there's a lot of stuff made by male creators, and it is just, like, it is literally, like, violence against, like, little girls for the sake of, like, violence. And I think that that's something that... I lost my train of thought.
I thought that was something that was very interesting when I was editing that last episode, is, like, particularly looking at characters like the Powerpuff Girls and being like, they're supposed to be, like, 6, 7? Yeah. And it's...
Or looking at... Yeah, and I mean, it's all about the context, too, right? Because Kagome and Inuyasha by Rumiko Takahashi, one of the most prolific mangakas ever, in my opinion, my extremely biased opinion, she's, you know, like, 14, I think, when it starts, 14 or 15, and, you know, like, she has, like, a super short skirt and, like, you know, a wider bust, maybe, but the way she's presented isn't through this, like, hyper-sexualized lens. I'll try to find so we can link to it. There's a really good discussion of this lens using Harley Quinn in Suicide Squad versus the Birds of Prey film. And it's all just really about, like, context, right? And I think as readers, especially as adult readers and people that work in a bookstore specifically, it's, like, part of our duty to do a bare minimum, like, sort of, like, background check into the content we're selling. Because I feel like so much of it in the wrong hands can just, like, it, like, really changes how people view, you know, women and disabled people and queer people and people living with disabilities and people living with mental health issues and, you know, the whole gamut. And, like, that's something that I think we work really hard to be very careful about. And, you know, one of the things I really admire about working at this store, for sure.
Yeah.
But it's something that I am always, always thinking about because I'm always concerned about, you know, accidentally recommending something to somebody that turns out to be real bad, you know? Sure.
I don't know where to take this necessarily.
Why don't we, on that note of, like, recommendation, yeah, not recommending things that are bad, what are some of the things that, like, you all or we all have kind of found to be really positive representations and or, like, particularly, I guess we can talk about it in two ways, right? We've kind of touched on the fact that we all have sort of comfort reads that we go to and kind of return to as dealing with. So kind of what are those and why necessarily? And then, but then also, like, in general, like, what kinds of books would you recommend for, like, our listeners that might be interested in reading more books from disabled authors or autistic authors, neurodiverse authors?
I wish I had more. I feel like I still do the thing where most of the fantasy stuff that I read, or, like, I read a lot of Star Wars stuff, and I don't feel like they're particularly, like, doing the work to show characters that are disabled or that are struggling with, like, different mental health issues or
as
whatever.
As a way of learning.
There is an author that I do really like. Matt Haig had a book out, I think, this year or maybe end of last year called Midnight Library that I haven't read yet. But I did really, really love, he had a book that came out a few years ago called How to Stop Time. And it was about this main character who, for whatever reason, had just genetically just has stopped aging. And so he's hundreds of years old. And, one of the things there's an organization of people that all, like, are like him, that just don't age, that are effectively immortal. And one of their rules is, like, don't fall in love. Like, don't get attached to people because, this is what's going to lead you to, like, despair or whatever. And the book has him return to London, where he lived with his wife in the 1600s during the Black Plague. And the book is intercut with, like, him in the present day revisiting places that he had been in his life, and then flashback chapters of him, like, going through, like, the traumatic experiences that he had at that, when he lived then with his wife. And I really liked the sort of dichotomy of that, the sort of wrestling with, like, revisiting memories that are painful. I think that Matt Haig has also written a lot of, like, nonfiction about his own personal struggles with, like, depression and suicidal ideation and things like that. So, like, I really respect the way that he's, like, brought that into his fiction. But I don't know any other, there aren't a lot of other authors that I've read recently that are doing things like that. I tend to find, I tend to find a lot of that in other media. Maybe that's just weird as, like, a bookseller being like, well, actually, I like to watch, like, this show or, like, listen to these podcasts.
I don't think that's weird. Everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. So most of my
Jenny and I at the same time. Please don't say it's weird.
Most of the fiction that I read does tend to be more on the, like, escapist side. And I get my sort of mental recovery through, like, other things.
Which is so funny because I feel like I'm the opposite. I'm sitting here, like, brimming with recommendations.
I was watching 90 Day Fiancé before we started this podcast. The reality television. Yeah. My escape.
Oh my god.
And my recharge.
I love dating shows. David and I are about to go watch the first episode of The Bachelorette.
Oh, that's fun.
I'm that person.
Becca, have you watched hashtag or Dating No Filter on Hulu?
No.
So Heidi introduced me to this.
Oh my god, just message me about it. I already okay. know. Like, I don't even need to know what it's about.
I'll do that. It's amazing.
But books, I want to recommend by Kabi Nagata. It was a really popular comic series on Pixiv, which is a, like, Japanese art website. And it's the first is My Lesbian Experience with Loneliness. And then the follow-up is My Solo Exchange Diary.
Mm.
I believe that's the follow-up. Yeah, Volume 1. Because then there's My Solo Exchange Diary Volume 2, which I believe, yeah, came out in 2019. Kabi Nagata talks a lot about dealing with intense mental, you know, health issues at the same time as trying to, like, gain independence from a very traditional Japanese family who at the time did not know that she was a lesbian because she was still coming to terms with being a lesbian. And the recommended age range is 16 and plus. I would just say, you know, reader discretion advised. It deals a lot with suicidal ideation and eating disordered issues and self-harm. So just please, you know, look up trigger warnings for this book specifically before you hop in, because it's really intense, but extremely well done. And then honestly, like, I know I literally recommend him every single episode, but I'm here to do it again. Jeffrey Brown specifically. No. Shut up. Jeffrey Brown, please come on the podcast. I am begging you at this point. But let's go in order. Pick up Clumsy, then Unlikely, and then AEIOU, also known as An Easy Intimacy. Oh. Those are the three books. Also Every Girl Is the End of the World for Me. Oh, that one hurts. All of those books are about his, you know, growing up in his 20s and having relationships and eventually meeting his wife and getting married after going through a lot. And he also has other books about his personal mental health outside of relationship health, including I Am Going to Be Small and Funny Misshapen Body. And I think that I wish that he got more notoriety for the work that he does about his mental health, because I feel like we struggle to see a wide variety of male health, like mental health discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not afraid to talk about it. Like, he literally did a whole comic about like how he feels about his physical body. And I think that's incredibly, like, not brave, but like bold, like, yeah, ballsy. Like, I really appreciate him doing that, because I feel like it's always expected for like people that were, you know, assigned female at birth to discuss body issues. But as someone that, you know, went through recovery for eating disorder issues, like, I really, really appreciate when men talk about how they feel about their bodies and about stigma surrounding how they should look, because it's important. So yeah, read Jeffrey Brown's comics.
I should, you've recommended his stuff so many times. I should just, like, get on that at this point.
You should.
Victoria, Jenny, do you guys have any recs that you want to shout out?
Victoria? I think some of mine are going to be the same as Jenny's, because I read them because of her.
That's fair.
So, I'm actually looking at the list and I was like, yep. The Kiss Quotient and the Bride Test I really enjoyed. Same with Alyssa Cole's Can't Escape Love and How to Find a Princess. And then Spoiler Alert and All the Feels, because I got the e-arc of that and it's so good.
Oh, that's awesome. I haven't started it yet.
I read them.
Becca, what are you doing?
I read them both.
I'm sorry, it was my birthday. And David drugged me away.
That's when you bring a book to read in the car.
Oh, no. I mean, there was... Everything happened so fast. Like, we did stops on the way to L.A.
Busy. So busy.
Another one is Dance with the Devil by Shailen Kenyon. And I feel like Shailen Kenyon is my Jeffrey Brown to Becca.
Absolutely.
I feel like that makes sense. I can recommend one of her books for pretty much everything. But with the Dance of the Devil, the main guy, Zarek, he is thought of as insane. and that he's just mentally unstable and crazy. And really, he's just like, y'all think I'm a monster, so there's no point in me trying to be nice and get along with you, because you're just going to shun me anyway. I don't see a point.
Yeah.
So if I can't even, you know, and I mean, he's one of the Dark Hunters, and it's this group of people who, like, you know, fights evil, but none of the other Dark Hunters like him. None of them want to talk to him. The squires who help the Dark Hunters, they're kind of like their assistants. None of them want to work with him. And he's kind of, at some point, thrown in the middle of Alaska and been like, okay, okay, this is your area to protect. But I don't mean, like, you know, a big city in Alaska. I mean, like, the nearest town he has to, like, take his, like, snowmobile to, and I think it has, like, 12 people in it.
Wow.
And so it's like, well, again, if you
very normal.
If you're going to think I'm insane, then what's the point of me even trying? And he
just, honestly, that's very relatable as a statement. As someone, you know, I'm sure we can all relate to, like, just at some point being like, you know what, if everyone's going to act like I'm crazy, I guess I might as well just...
I hate to make this comparison, but I have to make this comparison. And, like, this is like Kylo Ren telling Rey, like, oh, I can never go back.
Yes.
Like, these people think that I'm a villain. I can never go back.
And I was going to compare it to Kaz Brekker from Six of Crows, where he says in the beginning of Six of Crows, everyone thinks I'm a monster, so I don't need to do monstrous things. They're going to believe I'm doing it anyway. And that's, and just like,
all this is poor Wreck-It Ralph.
It is. It really, really is. And, like, those characters, they just made me, I don't know, realize, like, okay, if other people see me a certain way, it doesn't mean that's who I am. And I don't have to be okay with how they see me that way. But it doesn't mean I also have to try to change their opinion, because at some point, there is no point.
Yeah. Well, I think that's why it's so important to just, like, to be as authentic to yourself as possible, I think, when, like, presenting yourself to people, when, like, having conversations, when consuming stuff, like...
I think that I just have to say, and I'm sorry to cut you off.
No, you're fine. I don't know where I was going with that.
I just want to say that I think it's really easy when you don't have, like, any sort of, like, disorder that affects your personality.
Sure.
To say to, like... just be yourself authentically, no matter what. Mm. But, like, I don't know. I just, for me personally, my whole life, like, as soon as I, like, am authentically me, something happens where the person is like, are you okay? Like, I have a really easy, like, cry trigger. Like, I cry all the time over nothing. And I feel like a lot of people, like, want to say, like, oh, it's okay to do that. Just do it. Be yourself. But then, you know, the second you actually cry, everyone's like, oh my God, are you okay? Stop crying. And
yeah.
Oof. Oh my gosh. Well,
but, what about when you tell people about yourself and then they start crying? Because that happens to me a lot.
That's why I don't bring up, like trauma-based stuff around, like, strangers.
Yeah,
I don't want the look.
Same here.
The look that's... But then also, like, you know, you run into, like, if you don't disclose, then you end up getting, like, insanely triggered by some stupid thing that somebody says because they don't know.
Oh my gosh,
it's really tough. Like, I think everyone's upbringing is gonna be different. They're gonna have the different things they struggle with. Like, for me, like you're saying, Becca, about like crying easily in front of people or whatever, like, very much my stepdad when I was a kid was very much that person that's like a, like, oh, dry your, like pull yourself together, like man up, or like whatever.
Pull yourself up by your strap.
Yeah, just all that, all that stuff. All that toxic, like, you're not supposed to talk about your feelings. You're not supposed to, like, expose. Like, it took me a long time to overcome that. And then I have grown into this person that, like you said, cries at everything. Watching stuff, reading stuff, like, allowing myself to resonate emotionally with things that I otherwise would have, like, suppressed. And, like, it took me a long time to get to that point. I don't know. It's like, I think different people have different things that they struggle with. And so I know it's unfair to just be like, be authentic, like, to yourself. But like,
I don't think it's unfair. I just wanted to say, like, for a sure. lot of, like, especially for those living with, like, autism, mm-hmm. a lot of them have, you know, masking as a coping sure. mechanism because...
That's what I was gonna...
Yeah, like, you can't sense. Be your authentic self in front of people that don't understand your diagnoses because... Oh, the looks.
Well, and even then, even if there is, because I think of my sister. She yeah. is, she's on the spectrum, and she, I'm trying to think of how to say this. The things that, like, her books, because, like, I love books. I will always love books. They're everywhere in my house. I'm like the family in Inkheart. she, like, for a while liked dolls. And I mean, I never understood it, but she never understood me with books, and I just let her be her. But whenever if she took them out of the house with her, she would get weird looks. And I just wanted to be like, people, like, why do you care what other people are doing? Yeah. 'Cause even if you understand it, people are so prone to give a weird look because that's not their norm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's tough. I don't know.
You know, I have one more book recommendation.
Okay.
It's not from an... I mean, like, I don't personally know if the author lives with any mental health issues, but... the series itself is one that I always recommend to people because it is something that taught me the various ways that people deal with trauma and sort of like that it was okay to be a sensitive person. And that series is Fruits Basket. and I know it's like, ahaha, but also like that series, like it is one of those, like it'll get you because it looks like it's like this like soft, sweet, like, oh my gosh, like a high school, like, love triangle book. And they just happen to be, like, Zodiac, you know, reincarnations. But no, it is about centuries of familial trauma and, like, forced bonds and sort of how that shapes and changes people. And, like, it deals with, like, parental death and, like, different forms of abuse and sort of, like, the ways that people... react to that abuse and what they do to get away from it. And it is endlessly fascinating. Like, nothing gives me like a good space to have a good cry like that series does.
That's awesome.
Like, it's just the way it deals with mental health and trauma is so gentle. Like, it's like the way that you always imagined like wanting someone to comfort you, but like is just not a realistic like possibility.
Yeah.
Like, that book holds you the way you need to be held.
I feel like stuff like that's really, like, important in fiction, too, is just, like, the gentleness and the, like, oh, this character is, like, going through something and we're going to take this journey and, like, come out better at the end. Like, I don't know. I'm a huge fan of Steven Universe, which I find very soft and wholesome, even though it deals with some, like, heavy, heavy trauma topics for the protagonist a lot. For a lot of characters. And it's one of those series that, like, I think does the anime thing of, like,
oh, yeah. I mean,
talking to the villain and overcoming their baggage in order to, like, resolve it without a fight, right?
Well, not even that. Just, like, the first thing you said, like, everything about Steven Universe and the way it's designed is based off of, like, Rebecca Sugar's, oh. like, love note to...
Absolutely.
Like, sort of, like, magical girl anime, basically. Mm-hmm. And also, like, shonen anime, because... At the end of the day, it's not about, like, the fighting or, like, the cool outfits. Like, it's about, like, teaching a demographic of people about, like, caring about each other.
And yeah.
What, like, chosen family looks like and how to move on when things don't work out like they're supposed to, quote unquote.
Absolutely. Just felt very important when I watched it the first time and, like, has left a lasting impression on me. In a way that I wouldn't expect, like, an 11-minute cartoon to be able to do,
mm-hmm.
you know?
I mean, yeah, I feel the exact same way about Sailor Moon. Like, I know that on the surface for a lot of folks that didn't, like, grow up you know, with it. It just feels like a cute cartoon for girls or whatever. Mm-hmm. But like, to me, like, it is so fundamental to like how I think about treating people and like how I treat myself when like things are like really bad. Because like, I feel like a lot of like anime focused at children of a certain time period, like in that 90s to early 2000s, was very much about like trying to like enforce to kids that like you can be strong even if you are weak sometimes, and like if you have like a good support group around you, it will be okay and you can do anything. And I think that that is like the most important message to give a kid.
I agree with you. Jenny, did you have any that you wanted to shout out?
I'll shout out some. I feel like it might be a little bit of a downer. A lot of the books that I like are not necessarily...
Okay.
How do I put this? I don't find them quote-unquote depressing, but I would not describe them as...
Uplifting?
Like, uplifting, and they're not necessarily about recovery.
Okay.
For sure. The two recommendations I did at the beginning are not either, like... So I'm with you. I like to read the sad shit, too.
Yeah. Like, well, the things, like, for me in my experience that I, like, find the most helpful and the most validating are ones mm-hmm. that are not, they're not about getting past something or putting something in the past or in any way, shape, or form. As far as, like...
Would you say that it's more, like, about, like, being in the moment with the feeling or with the problem?
So, I think so. But also, like, about valid... Like, so, mm-hmm. okay, my lack of being able to speak right now is a symptom of me kind of being mid-burnout right now. Or, like, on the tail end of a burnout and trying to come out of it, which... You all know I have PTSD, and usually this time of year it flares. It has not flared this severely in a long time, but I struggled a long time with my experience in kind of the medical industrial complex, is what I usually refer to it, and my experience kind of getting through psychiatry and therapists and things like that was very long, a very difficult process that was full of people that didn't really listen to me and who didn't really, who would hear my experiences, but think I was describing something else, essentially. Or like, they were like, you're not describing this, you're describing that. And it wasn't until about like 3 or 4 years ago that I finally got treated for PTSD and things started to significantly improve. But so for a long time, books were really important to me as spaces where I could find voices that were validating my experiences and kind of like sharing them in a way that wasn't just kind of saying like, that's just your imagination, or that's just this happening, or that's mm-hmm. just because of this other thing. And appreciate kind of what that feels like. And that has, like, that doesn't always happen, I think, in books that talk about mental health. And one of the things I will say, and because this author gets picked up and is all over, like, Instagram, is always on BookTok, is always on Bookstagram, and she definitely has, I think there are issues with representations in her books, but I do think that, like, Sarah J. Maas's representation of trauma is a strong representation.
For sure.
And very complex. And the characters have nuanced and different experiences of trauma. It is not flat. This is what brought me originally to, well, brought me to studying literature. I've always been a fan of books, but me trying to find a representation of my experience of trauma that was not being reflected anywhere else because I couldn't understand what was happening to me and how I was responding. And it wasn't anything that I had seen reflected in film or books before. And so I don't think thoughtful representations of trauma are actually very common. And I do think hers are really good. Another kind of recent book, and this is not a fantasy book, but Normal People by Sally Rooney, I think does a really excellent job representing trauma. And especially representing kind of sustained long-term experiences of trauma that are repeated and how that sort of affects you. And there's two main characters. The Hulu adaptation is excellent, but I don't think it represents the trauma quite as well. It does a really wonderful job, I think, though, with the main male character's experience of depression and the intersection between kind of masculinity and depression for him, I think is really beautifully executed in the show and in the book as well. Don't think the representation of trauma translates quite as well. But that was one really, and then most recently, Victoria mentioned The Kiss Quotient and The Bride Test by Helen Hong. Helen Hong is an autistic author. She's local to San Diego. And she writes romance, and her romances have autistic characters. But she has a book coming out in August called The Heart Principle, and it's the third in the trilogy. And it is, I found to be very, like, emotionally moving, because I read it at like the perfect time for me to really, really identify with these characters. I am not autistic, but the burnout I'm going through has a lot of characteristics that can be also seen in autistic burnout, which is what the main character is experiencing in The Heart Principle. And so the other thing that speaks really well to, kind of what Becca brought up, masking. That book deals a lot with masking and talks about kind of the physical, like, essentially, and it deals a lot with like the physical and bodily effects of mental stressors and kind of masking. I'll just be masking in that sense. It's really, really beautiful and good. And I need to write my review, but I don't really know how. So I've been putting that off. And then the last one I will recommend, just because we have talked about it this podcast, was we've talked a lot about, or we kind of circled like the idea of like the mad genius sort of myth. I think it's kind of a weird myth. And Becca mentioned this in their notes, but this is a really problematic association for creators and like the toll, not just for like readers, but for creators, and how this can affect their understanding of their identity and their kind of mental experience. And a book that I think deals with that really well is Marbles by Owen Forney. She is bipolar. She is a comic artist, and it's a graphic memoir. And a big part of the graphic memoir is her coming to terms with her diagnosis and coming to terms treating that diagnosis.
Cool.
Yeah, like, I thought it was interesting how you had worded it as, like, mad, like, writer or whatever. I had not heard it, the, like, mad genius thing. I had not heard it as, like, in relation to artists and creators. Like,
Oh, yeah.
For me, like, it has always been connected, like, for me, I've always heard the suffering or starving artist. And, like, almost every currently, you know, prolific cartoonist and comic artist has a piece about this, because it's like almost all of us are told our entire life that like our suffering and our sadness and our mental health is like a beautiful thing that makes our work better, and like it literally doesn't. Like, I'm unable to produce even the smallest creation when I'm having a hard time. So it is, I hope as we like continue forward with seeing art accepted as like a viable career in this modern society, that
exactly
we just like ditch that term. Like, I think
one note on terminology though, when I say mad is being reclaimed by mentally disabled communities.
Oh my god, I love that.
So like mad pride is a thing and is a yearly thing.
I would like to participate.
Yes. We had talked about that a different time, but just to be clear, like,
I figured that was the case.
Identifying as mad is happening more openly.
I figured it was like a modern thing and I just didn't understand.
I think you understand.
No, I mean, like, I meant so far as, like, I hadn't heard it before.
It's
happening slowly.
I don't think it is, it's not as necessarily mainstream within mentally disabled communities. I think that there's still, as we started, like, there's tons of variability still. But that is a movement that happens. Margaret Price is a scholar I really love. She has a book called Mad at School that talks a lot about kind of mental disability, but that's where like the title comes from.
Nice. Okay, we're going to add her as well to the description.
She writes about mental disability in educational context overall, but so that's why Mad at School. But yeah. In Ellen Forney's book, like there's a few pages worth of kind of panels, just like of cartoons of the sort of quote unquote mad genius, like Virginia Woolf, Sylvia Plath, Vincent van Gogh, Emily Dickinson, Tolstoy, who did the Scream, Munch, like all of this sort of repeated things. And one of the things that she has to come to terms with in her memoir is like, but stability is good for creativity. And just because I'm stable doesn't mean I'm not bipolar.
Exactly. So, like these aren't like, I just wish that like, I hope that people continue getting away from the like curable sort of like terminology, mm-hmm. like manageable is the correct word.
Temporally fluctuating.
Yeah. Or simply vibing.
Simply vibing.
I had a great moment this week when I was talking to my therapist and I was like, it hasn't been this bad in 5 years. And I was like, it's been a long time. And she's like, that's not a long time.
Literally same. I'm like, it was so long ago. And my psychiatrist is like,
she's like, that wasn't so long ago. And I was like,
you're like, what do you mean?
What?
Okay. So Victoria and I do have to go.
Oof. But that's all right. I feel like this is a good conversation. Does anyone want to shout out like stuff that they're reading real quick before we like say goodbye?
I already did mine.
I picked up like 30 books over the weekend.
Incredible. We'll get into your reads on the next minisode then.
Yes.
Or people have already heard them by the time this comes out.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for being here.
I'm unfortunately in a reading slump. So.
Same. I finished Jen Lyon's House of Always, but I haven't started anything new since then. So
I have to just plug away like 5 pages at a time. Not The Heart Principle. I read that in like 48 hours.
That's how I do sometimes.
What am I reading now? A Spindle Splintered, I think. It's a novella by Alex Harrow.
Yeah.
That's coming out. And so far it's so far it's like there's illustrations.
Okay.
It's like nice.
I needed something like
nice. That's on my list to read.
That's awesome.
After finishing The Heart Principle.
Yeah, totally. I get that. I don't know. I haven't. Usually the way I consume stuff when it comes to like books or TV shows or like even games, like I find a thing that I'm like enamored with and then I just consume all of it at an ungodly pace. And so like I'm really bad at just like keeping just, you know, setting aside just a little bit of time to like read at the end of the night or whatever.
It was advice I got from a mentor of mine when I was working on my master's degree.
Sure.
And because like just in particular, when you're working on a PhD in literature, you have to read a lot of stuff that like is not quote unquote fun. It's interesting, but like your whole life is reading. You're reading things constantly for interpretive purposes and for it's your profession, essentially.
That makes sense.
And so one of the biggest pieces of advice was like always have a book that you're reading that is not for school, like something that you can keep reading to like maintain your love of reading. And for me, that just became like also something that really just affected my mental health because I could tell when I would do it intentionally and when I wouldn't and how that would affect me.
I think maybe I just need to like try and make a habit out of like spending even if it's just like a few minutes, like before I go to bed, like reading something. Cause like that consistency of going back and returning to it, like you're always going to make forward progress. Like I will finish books that way when I haven't been in like months, mm-hmm. you know? So, mm-hmm. okay.
And when I'm in a slump, rereading things I love slowly.
Yeah.
Because I don't need to pay as much attention to them because I have them memorized. Is like what I read until I can read something else.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah, I think that that's why I like tend to reread a lot of things is like, oh, at this, like I know this story. So this is just something comforting that I can just like spend some time with. Yeah. Well, thank you guys for being here. Becca already bounced because like we said, they were over, but, this was a good, I felt really good. Jenny, thank you in particular for like helping keep us on track.
Thanks. I'm sorry. Sorry if it comes off as
confusing. No. See, the thing is like this is what you do. And so like, I really wanted to like cede the floor a little bit because I don't always know what I'm talking about. And I like to have people who do like instruct me.
I don't know. It's
yeah.
mental health and mental disability and like rights and activism surrounding disability are something things that I'm hugely passionate about. So like talking about it, continuing to read and learn about it always is
awesome. Important. Awesome. Well, thanks again. Thank you, of course, to the wonderful Austin Farmer who allows us to use his track Kill the Farm Boy off his album Bookshelf Symphony Orchestra for our intro and outro. Links to that are in the episode description, as always. You can also find the bookstore. We are open again, open for business. People can come in and browse, which is so delightful. But you can find us, all of our social media, at Mist Galaxy Books. That's also always linked in the episode description. And we'll see you again soon in a galaxy not so far away.